At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. It's been a long time since this podcast. I can't remember how to do anything. I've had to go on YouTube and try and remember how to do all the sound and everything. So this might be rubbish. It might just be coming out of one ear or out of my arse or something. I don't really know. So I do apologise. I think it's part of getting older. So I finally finished the book, the Down book, and more about that in a minute. So in Down, there's 320 illustrations. I had to do all these stupid illustrations, which would have taken me an afternoon if I'd just taken a photograph. But anyway, all these illustrations, and there's an effect where you do an illustration where you create a black outline around certain parts of it. Well, you have a black outline and a white outline, so it makes it sort of stand out, a bit like a sticker. And I was doing this for over a year, doing these bloody drawings. And then it's a process. You highlight it, then you group it, and then you create an outline, then all this kind of, there's a thing, so you could do it in your sleep. And then recently I was doing another illustration for something, and I was I'll do the outline, and I was I can't remember how to do it. I started doing it, and I was it's not anyway. So I suddenly had this really horrible feeling about I was going senile, early onset, or maybe not that early onset dementia or something. But I think I've actually just got one of those. I like to tell myself I've got a brain. Where is it is it working memory? You've got some sort of work. I don't really know anything about computers, but I know that I've got a kind of brain where, if someone asks me to remember a telephone number, it's you open every window at the same time and loads of porn pop ups. If you want to remove this, send me €10,000 to this man in Uganda or somewhere. So my brain is a little bit like that. So maybe my working memory is very poor. So I can't hold the, that memory. I can remember the German army in the Second World War had an 88mm, shell, but I can't remember how to do this other thing. So some things go in another part of your memory and other things don't. So. I've not done a podcast for quite a long time, months and months, for various reasons. I just couldn't be asked, and there just seemed to be so much content out there. Luckily people have started, they've either topped themselves, or they've gone back to work or something, or they've just got bored. That's the world of creating free shit is a bit in the past, people would often say, I remember an editor of a magazine was there's been so many great climbing photographers, but none of them ever last. I'm like, yeah, because you don't fucking pay them enough. People will do things for free for a certain amount of time. Someone will produce a great podcast or some great, whatever, but it tends to die on the vine, because you can't, you just can't, it's just pointless basically at the end of the day. to do things for free. It's okay when there's like some kind of the end of the world. If it's the end of the world, then you might as well fill in your time by interviewing loads of strangers or doing loads of stuff for free, doing like yoga or whatever. But I can't be arsed doing that. I feel like I've been doing that most of my life. So if it's the end of the world, I'll find something else to do. So I stopped doing sort of podcasts for a while. Why else did I stop? Well, I guess I was doing the book thing. So the down book, which I'm always going on about, because it's a print on demand kind of book. Actually, it's funny that at the moment there's all this stuff about Donald Trump and how much tax he pays, and like anyone who tries to make a living being self-employed, they're like, God, I wish I could pay that little amount of tax. But the financial side of being self-employed, like if those climbing photographers had not been all like hippies, they would still be climbing photographers, because it's understanding the financial side of doing stuff for free or you know, to some degree, is what lets you keep doing it for long enough. So the down book, because it's like a print on demand book, so the economics of it for me is I can afford to spend like 2 years writing a book about abseiling if I kind of self-publish it, and I self-publish it through Amazon. So it means you make a normal book, you might make like 10% or maximum like 20% of the price of the book, which is like, if some books like Psychovertical, I have to pay like 20% of that 10% or 13% to my agent, and then you got to pay your tax on it and everything else. So by the time it comes down to it, maybe you'll make like 50 pence per book or something, which is good if you're J.K. Rowling or, you know, some kind of transphobe like her, or you're like that woman who writes books about you know, shagging, whatever her name is, 50 Shades of Grey. then you're all right, like 50p or even less than that, like, you know, 1p is good. It's like that kind of Walmart kind of model. It works quite well. But if you're making like niche climbing books where you're only gonna maybe sell like 4,000 copies, like a really, really good successful climbing book is probably gonna sell like 4,000 copies over about 20 years. So you need to really you know, get the sort of financial side kind of sorted. So down is a bit like Higher Education and Me, Myself and I, those kind of books which are like ultra nerdy and ultra niche, and so they're printed through Amazon, and loads of people hate Amazon, but it's a little bit, for me, it's a little bit like when Tesco's or these big supermarkets turned up, all these little kind of corner shops disappeared. And no one really seemed to give a toss about them. So you know, the same with like the games, all the game shops have all disappearing because you can download games, and or Spotify, like all the record shops have disappeared because people listen to our Spotify. But it's just the way it is. So run with it. Like anyone who wants to ignore the ability to make like 70% profit over like 7% profit is, you know, you can die on that hill, but you will die. You'll starve to death on it. So exploiting Amazon, I like to think of it. So the thing about the book is, because it's a print on demand book, like in the past, if you did a book, you would print, you know, like 1,000 copies, 2,000 copies, you know. So if you look at books like Ray Jardine's excellent book, highly recommend that, The Railway, something to do with like sort of like physics, but it's actually about like, you know, walking and shite like that, walking in the woods like an American, or The Big Wall Guide for Yosemite, you know, that I think they would like print like, you know like a lot of copies, like a garage full of copies, and then all those books would be sitting in the garage for, you know, a long time, hopefully not very long, but generally a long time. And you know, you have you have to store them, all that kind of stuff. And if you make any mistakes, which I always make loads of mistakes, you end up having like 4,000 books with like loads of mistakes in, and you'll never rectify them. So down, and most of the books I do myself are all print on demand books. So you order it and Amazon print it, or someone else prints it, and then Amazon like sends it to you anywhere in the world. So that's another good thing. Like if you want to buy a book from me and you live in Australia, or you live in Argentina or Greenland or whatever, it's a bit of a pain in the ass. If you live in Ireland, like I'm living in Ireland, so it seems to be very expensive to post anything anywhere. So people often want things, they want like books like signed or whatever, but I just can't be arsed doing that kind of, it's just too much faff doing it. So I just, it's just better for Amazon to deal with all that. So it's a very interesting way of, publishing, because it means that any mistakes, like I probably see mistakes in the book, like basically the book was finished and it was being sent out to everybody, and I didn't get a copy of the actual physical book until everybody else had got the copy. Just that's how it, I ordered my copy and I ordered everybody else's copy at the same time who'd got it on Kickstarter, because just after like 3 years of waiting, it seemed like it was good just to get the people the books. So almost everyone got their book before I did. So I saw people like on Instagram, like with a picture of the book going, oh, this is great. And I'm like, oh, that's what it looks like. So I eventually got my copy of the book. And then there's always like some, like it was proofread so much. It was proofread by Vanessa, my wife. She proofread it twice. It was proofread by loads of really people I really, really trusted. But yet there were still some mistakes. And even in the process of rectifying mistakes, you often make mistakes by copy and pasting the wrong thing or missing something. So there was some mistakes, and then I rectified those mistakes and uploaded a new copy to Amazon, and basically I'm on about version 21, and there's nothing, none of the mistakes are going to kill anybody. It's like basically like some grammar's wrong, or there's a italicized word and it shouldn't be italicized or whatever, or some nothing's going to kill anybody. But anyways, that's a really good thing about this kind of thing. A good thing is the book is massive. Like I would say, like, it's £25, which for all that work is actually very cheap, and the Kindle version is like €9.99 or $9.99, whatever. So all of them I think are very cheap, and for me that's like part of, by making a good margin on it, I can make it as cheap as possible, really. Like I don't want to make it like super cheap, because anyway. So there's also a version which is called like Down Core or something, which is just the abseil chapter, which is just about like basically fundamentals of abseiling, which is still very technical chapter, but it's like 16,000 words rather than 80,000 words, and I think that's like $199, dollars, pounds, euros, whatever, because that is that's kind of intended to be. Like every climber should have it. It's like a Kindle. It's on a Kindle. So everyone, you can use it on your phone or whatever. But like, it's that, the idea of that is like every single climber should have a copy of that, because it's only £2, because it'll make you a safer climber, and it'll make you, buy it for your friends or whatever. It's like it helps people. If people get that, it's £2. It's like less than the price of a coffee. It might make them buy the full version, which is going to be £10 or £25. But the idea is that every single climber in America, in the UK, whatever, should probably have this thing, because it's like I'm almost like giving it away. And I would have given it away, but I found through my I found in life that if you give things away for free, people don't want them or they don't appreciate them. So if you're trying to give something away, like a crap like rowing machine, no one wants it. But if you charge like £10 for it, like everybody wants it. So that's good that the Down thing has finally finished. It's got lots of like 5-star reviews, I've had many. I had like a mountain guide who was one of my trolls, a troll mountain guide. I think all mountain guides troll me, basically. I probably troll them back in everything. Everything in the world basically is about trolling, I reckon, at the moment. So, yeah, I had a mountain guide who was kind of trolling me, saying that in the book, I have like a few different ways of tying a rope together. So I have like an overhand, and I have a Gibbs knot and a half Gibbs, and then a few other like knots that you can use. And they get like more and more kind of, they kind of get a little bit more obscure. Probably the most obscure one is just using like an alpine butterfly, but tying two ropes together with an alpine butterfly, which is good if you're gonna like abseil with like a massive amount of weight on the rope. So say there was like three of you abseiling down, like if you can tie your ropes together, it's very easy to untie that. But most of them, most people are going to use like an alpine. No, most are going to use like an overhand, or a Gibbs, or a half Gibbs. And a Gibbs knot is basically when you tie the overhand, you just pass both strands through a second time. And a half Gibbs is you only pass one strand through. And the only reason you'd want to use like a Gibbs knot is if you're abseiling on like a 5 mil rope and like 10 mil rope or something. So that's why it's good for that kind of thing. Anyway, so that's all in like the $1.99 thing. So you'd have to spend the whole, if you're poor, whatever. If you're out of work, you know, if your COVID payments have been cut off, then that's for you, that thing. So yes, he was trolling me because I basically say like, just don't use a figure of eight, you know, don't use an overhead figure of eight, offset figure of eight, what it's called. Just because I just don't think it's very good to use it. And I have two people I know, they were abseiling, and they were like, you know, super super experienced climbers, and they were abseiling in kind of a wet weather, like it was pouring with rain in the Lake District. And one of them like tied the ropes together with a figure of eight, so an offset sort of figure of eight, and he abseiled on it. And when the other guy abseiled on it, the knot came undone, and he's like fell. And so luckily he survived, but he was like he wasn't tap dancing for a long time. He was in a bad way. So. And I just seemed, is this one of those things where you hear lots of people talking about that figure of eights are sort of dodgy, and you've seen tests where people say they're less strong than an overhand knot, and they roll and all this kind of stuff. And you know, often when people die or have bad accidents where the knot comes undone, like it's very hard to know what knot was there, because people, did you tie the right knot? Was there a mistake in the knot? So it's not an easy thing to really to deal with. And like ENSA in Chamonix, they did a load of tests with knots, and they basically said that figure of eight was fine. And I've seen some other instructional manuals in France where they say the figure of eight is the one to use. But for me, it seems counterintuitive, because a figure of eight is not as strong as an overhand knot, and it's also a bigger knot. And yeah, it's easy to untie, but like, why is that a good thing? So it's just a bit, and it's, you know, it just seems weird. And for me, I think it may come down to a guiding thing. Like if you're guiding somebody, apologize for that noise. If you're guiding somebody, do you want to have it doesn't look very confidence inspiring when you look at like an overhand knot. It's like, Christ almighty, is that it? You know, it's like, there you go, we'll wrap on this. It's like, oh my God, that looks terrifying. So in the past, where you had like a reef knot and it was finished with stopper knots, or like, you know, fisherman's knots, that looked like really, really, really strong. And it was really, really strong, but it was just bound to get caught in something. It was like a much bigger knot. So that was, so he was basically sort of saying, I don't agree with you, and you should use a figure of eight, and you shouldn't say it's dangerous when it's not. But it's my book, so fuck off. Anyway, so so yeah, in the book, there's a lot at the beginning of the book. There's a huge bit about namelature, we call it, and like administration, admin for the book. And there's a bit in there which just says, like, look, this book is written by someone who is not a qualified climbing instructor. You know, this is all my, you know, climbing experience in this book. Some things, like, so, you know, like I had a thing about if you have an abseil point where you feed the rope through, if it's flat against the wall, then I generally always feed the rope coming out of it. So when you pull the rope, you're pulling the rope out of the thing, not in towards the rock. And I had a message from someone from Poland who said he was always taught to do it the other way around. But I tend to do it that way because I like to have the knot on the outside of, you know, so I can see the knot on the outside, not like on the inside of the anchor, which probably doesn't make much difference. But for me, I quite like it that way. And I also, whenever I'm abseiling, if all possible, I always like walk away from the wall, so I've got as much, you know, so when I pull, so when the end falls out of the abseil point, it ideally it's going to come away from the wall. There's going to be no like friction or whatever, and I just find it's better, it works better that way than the other way, because the other way the rope can be, the two sides of the rope can actually rub together like a tiny bit, which doesn't make any difference for most of the time. But a lot of these things, it's about that 99.9999, you know, chance of these things happening, and they do happen. You know, like a thin rope will fall and it will like tie a knot into itself, and just loads of weird stuff that can, you know, if you abseil, like in the last, you know, sort of 5 years, you know, I must have abseiled like a thousand, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times, thousand times or whatever. And, you know, so you, and in my life, I've abseiled like a hell of a lot. And, you know, you just, most abseils go completely fine. Most abseils, you could tie the rope together with the biggest knot in the world. You could just, you could do it blindfold. It wouldn't really matter. And everything would be fine. But it's always in those times where you really need to, like, get your shit together. You know, you can't just, if you fuck it up, well, if you make one mistake, you're going to really, you know, you're going to make a difficult situation like a lot, you know, a lot worse. It's probably like if someone said, see this guy with his chainsaw, he's going to run after you. And if he gets you, he's going to chop your head off. You got like a 5 second head start. And then when you start running, your shoelace comes undone, you know, and your shoe falls off and you get killed. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about when I'm writing these books. So it's good that that's done. And now, like with all these kind of projects, now I'm on to like what am I gonna do next? Because I'm like, you always gotta, this is the thing about being self-employed. Like a few, like my ex-wife, who's an academic, she said to me, like when we were married, like I never appreciated how hard it was to work for yourself, to be self-motivating, which is kind of a nice thing. It's probably the nice thing, probably the only nice thing she ever said to me. But to be, it's really difficult. Like it's much easier, like just to turn up for work and be told what to do, and you do it, and then you get something else to do. But when you're self-employed, it's kind of hard. So now I have to think about what else to do. So I've got a few projects. I've got this book, this fictional book, The Bear Pit, which I've probably written like a third of it already. And I wrote it, I was in like America for like a few months, probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I spent like, I like drove around all over America. And I was like in Las Vegas for like 2 weeks, just sitting in Starbucks for 2 weeks writing this book. So I've got to kind of finish that. But I kind of worry, it's a little bit like, your brain sort of takes up the shape. Like, you know, like if you're, say if someone's really good at sport and they do a lot of, say like someone who's a builder and they're always got this physical job, and then you give them a job in an office where they're like looking after other builders. Like very soon that person who's like very fit and very strong will just end up like a fat bloke sitting in an office, because your body will adapt to whatever you're doing. And the same way is that, you know, if you start doing lots of gardening, you know, you'll suddenly feel like a lot stronger because you're lifting things and moving around. And I think your brain is the same. Like your brain just, you know, my brain was turned into like a brain, which is like a very like, yes, you insert the rope into, you know, the AB with your ABD, you know, pull this, blah, 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 underline pull. So your brain becomes like very technical and it's not very flowy. It's not very, it's just not very creative in that sense. It's purely like a Lego, putting all these Lego blocks in place. It's not really able to write anything very, very sort of simple or creative or expressive or whatever. So I'm kind of worried about just going back into this thing. Like in a way, you know, like if you had like a montage, if you wanted to write something really creative yourself, like everyone wanted to write bloody memoirs because they're all off, you know, off with the plague. They're all like sitting at home, nothing to do. Everyone's writing the memoirs. So one, I think a really good thing to do is to try and get into the habit of starting to write more creatively and just try and write something every day. Like the classic thing is you write like three pages by hand every morning. You know, you spend like half an hour to write out stuff by hand. But I think if you have a blog and you just start banging out something creative and don't care if it's good or bad, but just, you know, like if it's a montage, you know, it would be like instead of like carrying trees around and going for runs in the snow and, you know, like while Dolph Lundgren's like having electrodes stuck up his ass, you'd be, you know, you'd just be like typing. If he was a typewriter, it's really good because you'd have that bit where I like push the thing across and then I could put some more paper in. But with a computer, is a bit more crap. It's like switch on. Anyway, so you know, so, but I don't know if I've got time to really do that at the moment. So, and then the other two ones, I'm just trying to redo the Kindle version of like my Aid Basics book, which is like a little tiny book I did like ages ago, and which people still seem to buy. Like the higher education is like the 200,000 word version of that book basically, and this is like a little tiny thing. But I always in the book I remember this bit, and it says like metal to metal, like when you're aid climbing, it was just about aid climbing, as in really, really short for someone who's going to do the nose or something like that. It's like really just very, very simple, tiny little, you know, it's not very long. And but in it's about like metal to metal. So you have a fifi hook. When you get on your aiders, you need to get your fifi hook into the carabiner at the top. Like don't start going up like one step at a time, one fifi, you know, fifiing into all your daisy chain holes all the way up to the top. So it's like metal to metal. And then a few years ago, I was like climbing the nose, and there was these guys behind us coming up for quite a long time. And it turned out later on that they had actually read my book, and their whole thing the whole time was like metal to metal all the way up it. And so that was kind of funny. So whenever I think about this book, I always think about like those guys, like this is actually kind of useful. So I've been trying to do that. So I've been doing like the Kindle version. So Kindle, if you ever have to code, like Kindle coding is like a pain in the ass. It's like doing a website, and it just seems to be it looks terrible. Like anything with image, like words look okay on a Kindle, but anything else with images looks terrible. So the Kindle version of Down, it probably took me like a month or 2 months to finish that, because it was just death by like CSS and stuff, like trying to get it all to look okay. But again, that's another thing about being self-employed is you got a lot of time to learn all this crap and make loads of mistakes. And it's a little bit like going to university. Like if you want, I could have paid someone to do my Kindle, but instead I spent like my time is incredibly cheap, so I just spent my whole, like I've done loads of Kindle books already, but I just always forget how to do it. So it's like going to university then having like a serious head injury as soon as you get your degree and you can't remember the fuck all what you did. So it's a bit like that. So but then my other project is maybe doing a Kickstarter. Like Vanessa's like, don't do any more Kickstarters. Like don't do a Kickstarter unless you finished it and you just want, you know. But the Kickstarter thing, although the last one was like, you know, like 2 years late, like it was, I think it was so late that I think Kickstarter thought I died or something, because I couldn't like get a login anymore. But the to do one, trying to dispel the idea of someone being tough or hard, and like, you know, how to avoid, like, the art of not suffering, basically. So, you know, like how you can be like really, you know, like 50 degrees, minus 50 degrees, you know, wet weather, cold weather, how to dress and how to approach, not, you know, so you're not uncomfortable. Because for me, I think it's always an illusion in that people think, oh, this person is like very, very hard. Like, some people are more conditioned to the cold because of their, you know, they've just grown up in it. So they're, the way, like, I remember a few years ago, I went to this thing in Newcastle University, and they did this testing where I had to have all these like sensors, like temperature sensors, all over our skin, and I had to have one up my arse as well, like an internal one. And then there was a friend of mine, he was like a really good long distance runner, so he was like super, super skinny. I think he weighed like 56 kilos, I weighed like 100 kilos. And we had to go on these treadmills, and we were like, we had wet clothes and dry clothes, and we had wind and everything else. The funniest thing about it was like over 2 days. And for at lunchtime, we had to take our anal probes out. And the guy was like, go in that room and take your anal probe out and put it in that bucket with like water in it. So so I took my anal probe out and I put it into the bucket. And then the other guys was already in the bucket. And then when I came out, I was like, how will we know whose is whose? And he was like, we have more than two. It was like, oh, that's good. I probably told that story already. So my point was when we were doing what I noticed was when we were doing the testing was I came out a lot warmer than he did. Like I was like a lot fatter than he was. So I had some more sort of belly timber to keep me warm. I also noticed was the way I, like when we were walking into the wind, like I would put my arms behind me, or I would just look different to him. I was probably just more used to trying to conserve like body heat from doing a lot more stuff in cold places. And it's probably the same with I remember someone told me on a flight in Alaska that Inuits have shorter nerve endings or nerve pathways or something, so they could withstand the cold. But like I'm not sure how true that could be. Like I would think it's more to do with like they're better at not getting too hot in the first place, because like, you know, the trick to not getting cold is not getting hot, basically. You know, so people are much better like dumping heat really, really quickly and that kind of stuff. As soon as I thought about doing this book, then when I was thinking about the history and how we dress in the past. I've moved to County Galway. I'm living in it's a special name for it. It's a Gaelic place where everyone speaks Gaelic, basically. It's really funny. It's like a really weird like Irish Gaelic word. So I lived there. It's actually where they filmed The Guard. If you've never seen the film The Guard, definitely watch it. It's like a fantastic film with Brendan Gleeson. And also, while you're watching it, watch The General with Brendan Gleeson. That's another great film. It looks terrible when you start watching it. It looks absolutely shit, but it's a great film. I think it's on Amazon Prime. Yes, yeah, another little plug there for Amazon. I get like 1p every time I say the word Amazon. So we're living in Galway, near, like County Galway. So the weather here is like absolutely, it's not been too bad at the moment, but it is generally really, really shit. Like you're basically right on the edge of the Atlantic, and the rain is just like, you know, like it's like pretty intense. Like we had like water coming down. There's a vent. We have like one of these Arga cooker things, where like an oil cooker thing. And there was like water like coming down the chimney the other day, because it was just like you know, so wet. So when you live somewhere like this is a classic example of an incredibly tough place to live. Like I was just reading a while ago, I was reading like the, you know, biography of Oliver Cromwell, you know, and Cromwell came over to Ireland and they really, really suffered, you know, from the weather. Like in those days, they didn't really have any good like tentage or whatever. So like, you know, that's why you didn't campaign like in the winter time. But in Ireland, like the weather was like so horrific all the time. Like people were just wet and miserable, and you know, those people died of exposure and everything else. So it's kind of interesting, like looking at how people must have dressed in the past here and also in the UK. And then so I started looking at I was thinking like, what's a really good example of somewhere, like if you can move. You can stay warm in like almost any kind of conditions. Like, you know, anyone who's been running on a really wet day or really cold weather, you know, you can be wearing very little and you're generating your own body heat, so you can stay comfortable. But it's when you're standing around, that's like the worst. That's kind of the worst of it. Standing around when you're wet, or standing around, like yeah, standing around when it's just very cold is not so bad as long as you've got enough clothes on. But standing around when you're wet, you know, you're the heat just, you know, there's like just seeps out of you like so quickly. So then I was like looking up like in the First World War, like which is you had like oil skins and things, but they weren't being used in the First World War. So just as an aside, it's interesting, like, so a British soldier, they would wear, like, a woolly, like, woolen underwear, so they'd have, like, underwear bottoms and tops, and then they would wear, like, a mohair, but very thin, sometimes it was cotton, sometimes it was wool, but, like, a shirt that went over the top that had no collar, and that kind of probably created a little bit of, like, a windproof layer. Like a bit like wearing a Rab vaporized top or a dry climb top or something. And then over the top of that, then they would wear, sometimes they would wear like a comforter, which was something which was made by like people at home, like your wife, or people would make them and send them to soldiers. And that might be just like a waistcoat made out of wool. And then they would have their trousers were wool. And then they would have like a woolen, like a jacket went over the top, like a, you know, like an army kind of jacket. And then over the top of that would wear things like a gilet, like gherkin kind of thing. Is it gherkin? Jerkin. Made out of leather, which would like stop the wind. Then you had like sheepskin and you had, you know, but they would basically wear like lots and lots of layers of wool, which is probably, you know, probably similar to how like in Galway, there's all these photographs of, you know, women who were wearing, they'd wear like a shawl made out of wool, and then they would have like other wool layers like underneath. So, like it must have been like tough and very, very smelly. People must have been so smelly in the past. So it's like, you know, no one could really wash, and they were just going around in like, you know, dirty woolly clothes all the time. So, or maybe they weren't. Like when you go to, like in Africa, it's amazing how like people are living in what we would view as being like quite squalid conditions, you know, living in like a shanty, you know, shanty kind of housing. But like everyone's wearing like really, you know, clean t-shirts. You know, everyone looks like really, really immaculate. There's no washing machines or anything. Everyone's like hand washing everything. So maybe people weren't as smelly, but I know people, like the road to Wigan Pier, like George Orwell, I think he talks about how smelly people were, like working class people in the past. And speaking for myself, you know, like I have been smelly in the past, so maybe that is true. As a weird aside, actually, in my little looking up at this stuff, I ended up sharing a photograph of the soldier in the Falklands War, and I found this article about, in the Falklands War, they were using, some soldiers use like barber wax cotton jackets. And the reason that I think the Falkland War is interesting, because A, I've met I've met quite a lot of people who are in the Falklands War, like Marines and Paras and people like that. And I've met people, like, I mean, I've been to Argentina like 5 times. So I've met like people in Argentina who, one guy was like a taxi driver who'd been like, he had been wounded. It was in the Argentinian army, been wounded. And then, but then he was saying how nice, how good the British were to him. And they said, he played football with them. So I was like trying to think how wounded he must have been. So, and then I remember meeting someone who was like, their son was shot down and killed in, you know, in the war and stuff. So, but the Falklands War is like an interesting one, because it always seems to be at the end of, it seems to be like a bit like 1982 was, you still had this like old way of people dressing with this like new way, like approaching. So some people were wearing like fleece and Gore-Tex and, you know, fiber pile, and more kind of like modern kind of like outdoor fabrics, which are just coming online then. Like, I think like the SAS were given like Gore-Tex jackets by the American like Delta Force or somebody. And then, but then you had all these other soldiers who were wearing like gabardine and ventile and wool and, you know, silk and all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of an interesting period. And that kind of fighting in, you know, it was like sort of, some of it was like static in trenches and, you know, a lot of really miserable kind of conditions. And there must have been a big aspect of being, just being tough. But I know that, you know, you see some of the photographs of like the Argentinian soldiers, and they look like pretty miserable, like some of them, like the conscripts and things. And that's because like a lot of the conscripts came from the north of Argentina, where it was very hot, and then they were sent off to the Falklands. So, but unfortunately, in the process of doing this, I had this photograph of someone wearing a barber jacket, and there's a really good article online about how soldiers had these like modified barber jackets. And a barber jacket was probably quite expensive then, so it would only be like officer level probably. But I think a barber jacket, you can probably just sew anything onto it, because it's, I don't think it's like sealed, you know, if you just put some more wax on it, probably waterproof or water resistant. But I mentioned this aside, that Rab Carrington, he made down gear that was like subsequent, like when he was in Argentina, that was subsequently used in the war. And the story I'd heard, like I once, like years and years ago when I was living in London, I organized this event at the Alpine Club. And I really, you know, I was like very, I'd only started working in like an outdoor shop like a few months before, but I was like super keen. And I somehow managed to get Rab, who terrifies the fuck out of me, this like scary Scotsman, and Hamish Hamilton, who started Buffalo, who's like the guy behind Buffalo clothing. So he's kind of probably one of the fathers of like soft shell, basically. I got them to come and give a talk at the Alpine Club about like clothing and equipment and stuff. So, but like hardly anybody came, because this was the day before social media. I just went around and stuck some posters up in people's shops and things. But yeah, Rab told the story how he was in Argentina, and there's but like a dock strike, so none of their equipment had turned up from Britain. There was a dock strike in Liverpool. Their gear didn't turn up, so he had to wait like a few months for it to turn up. And he got a job with someone making like down clothing and you know, down sleeping bags and all this kind of stuff, down jackets and things for the army. And then this was like 1973. And then like in 1982, like he switched on the telly and he saw like the Argentinians like invading the Falkland Islands, or the Malvinas Islands, depends who you're talking to. And there you could see these people's like Argentinian special forces, like commandos, wearing like the jackets he'd been making and stuff. And I always thought it was like kind of a cool story, but it was weird. Like, I sort of posted it, and then some people were like, I think some people have this filter, like anything I say, I'm trying to troll people or trying to be controversial or trying to stir the shit, which I'm not at all. And it ended up being like, you know, like, oh, you're trying to say that we shouldn't buy Rab products because he was selling stuff to the army or whatever. And you know, and oh, it was like he was in 1982. He was living in, you know, Doncaster or whatever. You know, like I wasn't saying he was like in Port Stanley with his sewing machine banging out like down socks or something. But then someone who I really respect sort of like chided in and was basically saying I was like making it up and I was like lying or something. So like Vanessa's always like, don't engage, just don't reply, like it's social media, it's not, don't, you know. But for me it's always a little bit like if someone says, oh, you're a paedophile, and then Vanessa would be like, don't even reply, it's not, you know, don't, you know, it's like not good to reply to these things. So for me it's like I'm telling the truth, this is what Rab told me. So I ended up you know, replying a few times, and not in a very fairly respectful, but more, but mainly like annoyed, because I just had about 3 months off social media where I had no social media whatsoever. I didn't have Twitter or Facebook or anything, Instagram, and I always have this intention of like not going back on social media, and like I always delete all my tweets. Because the idea is that, like, you've got, like, a window. I guess Twitter must have been off for less than a month, actually. It feels like 3 months. It was only less than a month. Because I didn't use Twitter for, like, a month or 2 months. And then I deleted it. But you've got, like, 30 days until it dies completely. And I always delete all my email, all my tweets. And the idea is that there's no real incentive to go back. And I'm like, I was like sticking to it, and I didn't want to go back to Facebook and all this kind of stuff, because it is just like so toxic. I just don't want to engage with it. But then towards the end, you're always that part of you that's like the business part of you is like, yeah, but if you're going to do another book, how are you going to tell people about it? Or if you're going to, you know, it's like the mafia, you know, they always pull you back. So I was trying to be more, have a more positive interaction with social media, like making it do what I want it to do, not do what it wanted me to do. So I was trying to be, you know, like, fuck off, like, I'm not lying, you bastard, or whatever. But I think ultimately what it was this friend of mine, who's Argentinian, like, he hated the idea of this guy who Rab was working for making gear for the army. Like, I don't think he could accept that this guy was like a hero of his. He would never have made gear for the army. You know, like, you basically had, you know, look up the history of Argentina and the army there. Like, it's not good. It's like making stuff for the SS or something. It's not good. Anyway, but it turned out, I think he just thought I was making up or lying or whatever, something. I just got my wires crossed. But then it turned out that was the case. He had a contract for the army, so I wasn't lying. But it's like one of those things where, like, everything is always so, you know, it's like a really shit game of chess, basically, where you just have one piece each. And you just try to smash the other person over the head with it. You're like, it's like the size of a brick. You're just like smashing each other the head. Anyway, so basically I beat him. Like, he said I was lying and I proved he was wrong, you know. But then I was like, it's so shit. Like, if this guy, basically I've just said, like, oh, this guy you respected, he was like selling shit to the enemy, to the junta or whatever. And you're wrong and I'm right. So I just like sent him a message. I was like, forget all this shit. Like, what is actually going on? Like, why are we arguing over this? You know, like, what's really going on? And he hasn't replied, so hopefully he will. But I think that's one thing, one reason I've tried to get off social media is like, it's totally dementing people. Like, people are losing their shit. Like, totally rational people are completely losing their shit. And like, I still intend to do this other podcast, this like the Dogma of Certainty podcast, and I've actually got some music. Someone's created some music for me for it, which is kind of cool kind of music. Because I do feel like this, I feel like the, like everyone is like really sane people I never thought would succumb to this like mania, really, really losing it. And it's, you know, it's like really, it's like really, 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 really scary. Even like, I live here in the, like literally the middle of nowhere. Like it doesn't really, I don't really care. It doesn't affect me if you have like a civil war or whatever in America or whatever. But I do really hate to see people just becoming so, you know, sort of manic and manic and crazy. But like what, like with I've spent like a lot of time here, like outside, because where we live is like a, there's quite a lot of, it was like completely overgrown. It's about a hectare, which is like quite a big amount of land, which was completely overgrown, like up to like head height brambles, like thick brambles, and all loads of like just crap. Like as I've been like trying to cut it all down, I found like a cement mixer and, you know, loads of just shit that was just been left here for like forever. And like, but for me, like just not having any social media and not really interacting with a computer as much as possible. Like I still don't own a phone, so that's like one, like thankfully that's one really great thing. Just like listening to podcasts is like the only real interaction with like the rest of the world, apart from watching The Boys on Amazon. Boys, that's in the TV program, not like Boys, you know, I don't even think, nothing wrong with watching Boys on Amazon. But you know what I'm talking about, The Boys, the superhero thing. So for me, like it was funny because, do you know, if you have to like cut down like several tons worth of brambles and shit, is that you really see the result of all your effort of being like totally knackered the whole time and covered in scratches and, you know, people walking past and like commenting on how much better it looks and all that kind of stuff, instead of being in this kind of virtual cyber world. And another thing I've noticed is that like Vanessa has spent a lot of time in the house and she's been like painting walls and all that kind of stuff. And she listens to talk radio all the time. And if I literally have to tell her to like switch it off, because I find it is this like constant, it just makes you so stupid and so ignorant. It's like it sucks all your intelligence out of your brain and all your balance, and you know, you become the, you know, this like, what's it called, the extreme middle, you know, like, you know, you can't be in the middle, you've got to. And the more, like I always say to her, like today I got to switch it off because I just couldn't stand it anymore. It's about the Trump Biden sort of debate, and I'm just like, it's not about supporting Donald Trump, but it's not about supporting Biden. It's about the media, like the way what it is doing to people. Like it's not just about, it's not like we watched that program, the social dilemma, which is kind of interesting. Kind of, it's interesting to watch it because, you know, like I've been writing about this thing. I think I have an article I wrote, like I definitely had one in 2017 called Dogs on my website about this kind of thing. But I wrote something like, you know, 2014 about this, what's going on. So I feel like I've been very aware of it for a long time, but it's, the more you get aware of it, the more hypersensitive you are to it. You know, it's really, it's like, yeah, I find it kind of terrifying. There was something that the other day I had to drop my son off at the airport, and I had to drive. It was like 5 a.m. driving along, and there was something on the radio, and it was about this book in France, and it was called like, you know, Men Are Scum or something like this. And the person was saying, this is a very controversial book, and it's been reprinted, and we have this man here, like, you know, what do you think about it? And the guy's like, it's terrible, men are scumbags, oh, blah blah blah. And then there's a social, you know, it's like a, you know, war, blah blah blah. And then there's another person going, well, men are bastards, and you know, we have the patriarchy, and you know, slavery, and blah 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 blah. And then there was somebody else, and was like this book has only sold 200 copies, and they've reprinted 400 more copies. Like, why are you talking about this? And the person was like, well, but you know, what do you think? Do you think men are scumbags? And the whole thing is completely manufactured. Like, your like outrage and your discombobulation and your general psychosis is just kind of being monetarized. And we have this game whenever we put 10 on the radio, it's like, what's being talked about? Let me guess, COVID. And every time you put the radio on, it's about COVID. So if like COVID had never happened, what would they be talking about? They'd be talking about Donald Trump. And if Donald Trump wasn't happening here, what would they be talking about? Brexit. And if Brexit never happened, what would they be talking about? Like, there's like, if Trump loses the election, which I think he probably won, because of this, in a way, is that people are incredibly, people are much more smarter. Like, and that's the thing, is like, I really don't mind being manipulated and being brainwashed, but I expect it to be higher quality than what's going on right now. And I think most people are the same. And I think you have this, you know, the classic silent majority people are just people who just can completely see through all this. And they really, you know, I miss the days of, you know, when the BBC did this well, and, you know, you'll see, you know, like two women kiss on Brookside, you know, in the late 80s. And it was like shocking. And it's like, oh, well, maybe there's not wrong with lesbians, you know, and then you'd see like a black guy and a white woman going out on EastEnders, like, oh, maybe there's not wrong with it, you know. So it's like this kind of slow thing. But now it's just like, it's just crazy. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but basically, like, you know, it's just mad. It's like, what's it, information paralysis? There's so much information. So that's the one thing I like about podcasts, basically, is that you have like an hour of like two boring people talking to each other, you know. And it's much harder to be really outraged about two, you know, like two people just talking, you know, over Zoom, you know. But when it's, you know, so I quite like the podcast. So that's one reason why I decided to do some more podcasts, because I probably get through like three or four podcasts every single day. And, you know, and you can, it's like, you're a bit lost, aren't you, really? You'd have to read a book or something. I've been playing quite a lot of chess, although not a lot, but like every day I play chess once a day. sound like I've got all posh, haven't I? God, listen to me. I live in the countryside playing chess, doing the garden. I'll be booking bed watching next. No, I'll kill myself first. So that's why I thought I'd do some get back to the podcasting. But I did see a thing because I was going to do some more podcasting. I actually went to the Apple page where this podcast is, and I've got lots of really good reviews. But I had a 1-star review, and it was like, this guy sounds like uneducated and ignorant. And he is 40 minutes in, he still hasn't got to the what the subject matter is. So I guess this podcast is for that person, whoever that was, because I don't think I'm not even going to get to the subject matter. I've been speaking now for an hour, and I was going to talk about some other things, but I've kind of got sidetracked on all the other stuff. But it has been a while, hasn't it? Like, this would be like as me and you like meeting up, and like, what have you been up to? And I'd just be like, basically nothing's happened. This is me talking about basically nothing at all. So I think I should finish it there. And I do have some I was going through my, I got going back through my emails, and when I was like podcasting every week, I had quite a lot of really good, cool questions people asked me. So I'll do another podcast next week, and I'll like actually answer some of those questions. But anybody else has got any other questions? I think some of these questions I might have answered them already on another podcast, but I can't remember. So I'll answer them all again. So it'd be like a good, be like a sort of Christopher Nolan film. Like, oh my God, it's like deja vu. Anyway, so so that's it. I don't think I've got any more news. Hope you're all, everyone's all okay. I've got 58 pounds in my bank account at the moment. So I don't want anyone to think that I, or 58 euros, but it's probably same in pounds. And so I don't want anyone to think that I'm like in my ivory tower here. You know, so just you know, it might not be true. I might have like fucking millions in my bank account, but anyway, I actually sent that a screen grab of my bank account details, and I sent them to John Barton, my publisher, and I was like, just to tell him that, like, you know, remember me, like, you know. So it's good to, you know, I just because I feel guilty, like I'm making it sound like I'm living in, like, you know, luxury, but I'm down there with everybody else. Like, if you're struggling, if you're having a hard time, then I'm with you. Solidarity, brother. Anyway, that's it. Goodbye.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.